Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now. And support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to accomplished investor and equity analyst Neil Shah of Edison. So welcome, Neil.
Hey, thanks, Paul. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, we've had lots of big macro news over the past month, not least this week's US CPI and PPI prints. But before we sort of dig into the details, I suppose you could quickly sort of like tell the audience what type of investor you are, what kind of stocks you like.
I've tilted things over time. But, you know, the sort of classical approach is that you look for companies where you see... smaller companies, typically, where you see earnings growing, and then with that growth, you get this sort of double whammy of the re-rating on the valuation side. I've had to pivot that a little bit over the last two or three years. So there's two strategies, effectively, that I tend to look at. One, which if you come to the Edison website and sort of dip down to the bottom end of the insights, you'll come across a model portfolio that we run, which is called the Illuminator. And I can explain that in a little bit more detail. But that is effectively high-quality momentum investing. It's right. Finding companies with the right kind of attributes. And I'll go into a little bit of more detail on that in a second. The other, which I now look at, and really it's a sort of reflection of the state of the sort of UK takeover activity that you're seeing, is, I mean, I think to a certain extent, because there's a sort of, it's hard for institutional investors effectively to buy stocks right now. You're looking for things where, you know, you are going to get some kind of realization of value. So I look for things which are quite beaten up, where you might start to see a little bit of a turnaround, but also that there is corporate activity in the sector. So it's a fragmented sector, or, you know, for out of need, that industry is going to consolidate. And we look for stocks where you might see that kind of sort of consolidation taking place. The stocks I'm going to talk about today, I've really focused on the Illuminator. What is the Illuminator? Yeah. Well, when I was a young analyst at Goldman, learning my trade, I learned from some great people, but I always remember meeting this guy who ran private wealth money out of the US, and notable because he didn't take up partnership at Goldman. He was making too much money doing all he's doing. And
wow.
His name wasn't
Warren Buffett by any chance, was it?
No, but he had a really simple approach to things, which I really liked. And often investing is quite simple. Don't need to complicate it too much, which it starts with the efficient market hypothesis, which is, what is it that I know better than the rest of the market? And, you know, he sort of told me that, look, I can't tell you which tech stock's got better technology than another one, or which healthcare company's got, you know, better science than the other one. But I said, I can sure tell you what the attributes of a great quality company is. And we have for a period of time. So, I mean, I listened to him and I learned a lot about those attributes. And what I did was that I then, it, actually in the sort of coverage of the building material sector, which I did at Goldman's, I actually took those and turned them into numerical proxies. So I would screen the market for certain things that I felt were reflections of the things that you're looking for. And, you know, what is it that makes a great quality company? I mean, first, it's, you'll often hear fund managers like Gervais and people talk about that, you know, high quality product or service. You always look for that. You're looking for superior management and management who are sort of acting in the interest of shareholders. Larger than average compound earning. And really, this is, you're looking for companies that grow faster than GDP.
Yeah. EPS, a certain amount of top line.
Yeah.
Both, yeah.
EPS. EPS, I mean, we do look at top line, but it's the bottom line that matters the most. Consistency and predictability of earnings. So it's this idea that, you know, great quality businesses have people who keep coming back and buying from them on a repeated basis all the way through the cycle. And you can see that in the numbers. The sort of balance sheet needs to be, you know, efficient, but not overly leveraged. It means that you protect yourself through shocks. You're looking for reasonable levels of profitability. And I tend to focus on ROE and return on capital employed measures. And the profitability is important because if you're growing, you don't want, you know, you want to invest in companies where they're not constantly sort of coming back to shareholders for funds to continue growing. So it's that internal generated cash flow that's redeployed.
What sort of level are you be looking for a ROCE?
I mean, I tend to look for, you know, it's things in the sort of 19, 20 sort of is my sort of benchmark, except
percent.
It's not always perfect. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. So it's one of a number of factors that I tend to look at. Free cash flow generation. So, you know, making sure that the profits is actually turning into cash is important. International competitors. So it's really, I'm looking for businesses where it's not just often, you know, it's not constrained by just being a domestic player, that there is a scalability opportunity. So what can they do on a wider basis? And then finally, of course, valuation, which is, you know, try and enter into these things at a reasonable purchase price, which doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you don't buy them when they're trading at a premium. Great quality businesses often do trade at a premium, etc. But it's trying to find a sort of entry point where you've got a little bit of a margin of safety around that. And I basically have created the secret sauce. I've created effectively numerical proxies that sort of pick up on this. We run a factor model. So, you know, 10 factors, we sort of run, screen the UK market, and it creates a portfolio of you know, so it ranks the companies, you know, one to whatever, 1800. There's some liquidity constraints we look at, but it will, you know, why I tend to focus on what are the top 10. And then the companies are sort of bubbling along. And we publish the top 10 on the website, so you can go in and have a look. You might need to put your, you know, register once, et cetera, but there's no, you don't need to pay for it.
Yeah.
And the track record, so I started this in, I think it was about June 2008. And my the model portfolio returns, so same period, UK all share is up about 161%. The Illuminator is up 1,479%.
Oh, well,
so
done.
It gives you an indication. And look, I mean, within that,
what's the annualized return on that? I'm guessing it's probably what 15 years. It's probably 15% per annum.
Yeah, something like that. 15. I haven't broken it down, and it's something which has. It stands the test of time. Sometimes it does underperform on a short-term basis, often whether dash to trash and, you know, some more things happening. But I'm a great believer that, you know, if you buy into high-quality businesses over time, they will endure, that you'll get the returns. And, you know, actually in those numbers, I think all you're seeing is that power of compounding. You've got a set of businesses that you know, keep returning, growing, et cetera, and you're seeing that sort of coming through in the numbers. So that's the Illuminator. Current top 10, 4 Imprint, Kainos, Rolls-Royce, Global Data, Impact, Softcat, YouGov Computer Center, Gamma Communications, and Serica. And I know we'll go on to
Yeah.
talk about those.
Okay, well, let's go into it. Let's just right into Rolls-Royce, shall we? Because obviously it's been a huge turnaround over the last 2 or 3 years. They had a new CEO. I mean, I called this one wrong because when he came on and came to the top of the business, he said it was a burning platform, the company, and I thought he was going to
Yeah.
kitchen sink the numbers, and he hasn't. He's actually turned it around really well, and the shares have literally, and this is to sort of coin the pun, is to taken off, haven't they? They've done absolutely fantastically. But I guess the question
Yeah.
now comes to, having had such large gains, is what do you do next? Because it has re-rated and there's now a bit of optimism behind the story. But is it one to hold or to even add perhaps, potentially?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think there's further to run. So let's take a I think it's an interesting story because, I mean, one, you know, if you for those who are listening, if you take that chart and you put it up against Apple and Alphabet and you know, some of the other, I mean, apart from Nvidia, actually Rolls has done better than those names.
I can see
And you
why
know,
your
you
Illuminator portfolio has done quite well.
and
Of helped returns, hasn't it?
yeah, and look, I mean, that's the thing is that it tends to pick these things up reasonably early, so they can start to see effectively that you're starting to build momentum, and that is, you know, part of what we're trying to identify, which is these are potentially winning stocks. I think that firstly, you know, it's I like this story because it you know it's a UK champion. It to me, it's a great example of the fact that you don't need to be just invested in US growth stocks, etc. Here is a story that's done really well, and you know, actually, if you take this stock and some of the other great runs, M&S, etc. And you know, ran the same levels of concentration as the Magnificent Seven. You know, I think that there's it probably shows you that there's some great stories in the UK market. So, what do we like about it? So you're right. I mean, for a long time it underperformed. It got absolutely hammered in the pandemic. So what does Rolls do? It's got four broad sort of areas of operations. Civil aerospace, which is basically the sale of aircraft engineers, engineering, and the repair and maintenance and provision of spare parts. It's got a defense division, so it, you know, supplies to military aircraft. A power systems business, which is power generation equipment for naval vessels, submarines, and then the nuclear business, which I think is interesting in terms of the future, but not necessarily now. It's particularly the modular reactor business. It had been struggling for a while, and then the pandemic came, and of course, you know, the civil aviation side of the business just completely collapsed. I mean, and you know, they earn recurring revenues effectively from, you know, flight time, so on. And Warren East came in to start to clean it up, and then the current CEO Tufan came in to take that journey forward. So I mean, fortunately, he'd sort of inherited to a certain extent, you know, the initial starts of a restructuring around the business. Now, what's caused the change, and what do we like about it? Firstly, I mean, you know, for those who are sort of, you know, focused on return on capital, etc. I mean, the civil aviation business, incredible know-how, really strong moat. I mean, they compete against the likes of GE. There's two other sort of
Pratt &
Safran. There's a
Whitney's the other
couple of
one, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. They compete, but I mean, yeah, they've been doing a really long time. There's an enormous amount of know-how, etc., which is very hard to replicate. They tend to be the preferred supplier to Airbus, and you know, I think to a certain extent we got lucky with the woes of Boeing this sort of last 12 months, and that's helped them. There is
Pratt and Whitney have
what I
also
like.
had Pratt and Whitney's also had engine problems, hasn't it?
Yeah, so I think you know what I like about it. Firstly, you know, when you look, I meet lots and lots of management teams and CEOs, I think the art of the CEO is to take a complex situation, simplify it, and sort of turn it into a set of, sound bites that his troops get and can follow. And I see that in the new CEO. I like the way he sort of explains the business, and he's pretty straight talking about it. So
Have you met him?
I've never met him sort of in a sort of one-to-one situation. I've seen him present, but I've never met him in a sort of a one-to-one situation. But I like what I see there. I think that the other thing I like is that in terms of turning this around, I mean, they're fortunate that I think the civil space, a civil business has started turning around. But they've been much more disciplined on the pricing side of things. So it used to be that all about some market share gains that, Airbus wants to win a particular order, you'd flex on price, et cetera. And then, you'd see that sort of impact the margins. They've been much, much stricter about that. And when about, I'd say probably 18 months ago, maybe it was 24 months ago, when he was sort of talking to the investment community and kind of explaining the way forward of the business. There was a lot of people who were skeptical as to, are you going to actually be able to deliver it? And he's gone out and actually not only just delivered, but exceeded expectations, both on the margin, but in particular the cash conversion from those sort of margins, from the profitability. So there's a, it's got a lot of positive momentum behind it. And I think the next level effectively of streamlining and making roles a more efficient business is the bit that's going to take this business going forward. Now, in terms of where is, sorry, go on.
In terms of valuation, I was actually having a quick look, and although it's sort of like, soared over the last, what, 3 years, and almost, well, more than trebled, it's on 12 times EBITDA. And you compare it against GE, which is largely now its aerospace business, because it span out its healthcare business. That GE's on 18 times. So actually, it's not, I mean, it isn't cheap, but it isn't absolutely expensive.
No, and look, I mean, I think there's two parts to this, which is that, once you start to see the sort of momentum of the story and other opportunities start to open up for them, we tend to focus on, what's in front of us, right? Which is fine. There's other optionality within the stock which could take it further. So, from my view, compared to when you're looking at it on EV/EBITDA measures against peer group, arguably it's somewhere between, there's 25 to 50% upside to where it could get to. And if the company continues to do what it's done, which is deliver effectively that growth in operating profit and cash, I think there's potential and surprise on the upside. I think there's further to run. The other thing you'll notice is I don't think it's dividend paying right now. And one of the things that as the cash generation improves, you're probably going to see a re-rating of their debt. And once that happens, but that it's the potential to start returning effectively some capital to shareholders as well. So I think there's another bit to the story there.
When do you think they'll do the dividend reintroduction?
Well, I think the signal has been that they want investment grade debt first. And to be honest, you're in the hands of the ratings agencies there as to when that happens, et cetera. But that's the signal to look for. And then I think shortly afterwards, you probably, if you're an investor in it, you want to engage with the management team at that point in terms of what is dividend policy going forward.
Okay, good. All right. Okay, well, we've got a quick question coming in from RP Invest, and he's asking about basically the CMA's review of the vet market, the industry, and obviously it's hit the CVS share price again this week. So there's two issues. Is one just on that one, and then also how would you play sort of regulatory issues? Because we've got another one going off, which is the car insurance potential mis-selling, and how would you as an investor sort of like, position the uncertainty associated? Would you buy on the dip with sort of like, when there's blood on the streets, or would you actually or wait off, and then specifically on that CVS side?
So I think, look, I mean, I think you've got to take these things seriously. I mean, the CMA doesn't step in unless it sees there's a real problem. And inevitably, once your pricing comes under scrutiny, Then you know that tends to have some kind of margin impact, and that's what the market is anticipating effectively with Pets at Home, with the CVS, etc. You're seeing that sort of impact in the share price. I don't know them well enough. I mean, the way I tend to do these things is you need to do it on the basis of some kind of margin of safety, which is you take, you know, current earnings and earnings projections. You take a view as to, okay, what would be a kind of normalized impact on margin? What is your valuation tell you there? And then just how much sort of protection do you have at that point in time? So I haven't done the work on that, but that's typically how I would tend to look at it. And my experience of these things, I've been through various things like this where, you know, there's asbestos risk and, you know, various sort of contingent liabilities for companies. It tends to hang around for a while. I mean, people tend to shy away from it. It's just you don't want to take the risk
Yeah, look at
for a
P look
period.
at PPI.
So look, I mean, and that, you know, it's a little bit of a chain around the neck. So it does lead to opportunities, but just bear in mind that the realization of that might take a couple of years to actually work itself through.
Yeah, no, I mean, typically for myself, if you've got industry, it's a great, to me, it's a great opportunity. If you have specific industry expertise, you may work in the sector and you can actually cite it and scale it and quantify the potential loss, then you've got better information than actually the market will have. But as an outside investor here, for me, for instance, I would just keep away from it if I'm not in it, simply because I haven't
No,
really got a
I'm looking,
clue.
but I think you also got to be, you know, listen effectively in terms of how significant of an issue is it. So it just so happened that, you know, the CMA investigation, I sort of read about it, and 2 days earlier I'd been reading about how expensive vet bills had become, and that people are doing
Tell me about it.
holidays and, you know, they're etc. And so, you know, I think it's a genuine issue, the effect that they're looking at.
Okay, good. Well, let's move on to another one in the FTSE. I mean, there's one I would like to highlight to investors, Smith and Nephew, which probably people know is the archetypal orthopedics medical devices business. So it does hips and knee joints, etc. But also has got other divisions like sports reconstruction, if somebody has an injury, and also sort of advanced wound care. This is one which basically has been really sort of like, you know, static for absolutely years, and it's similarly got another it's got another sort of recent let me share the screen. It's got another recent CEO change. In fact, that's probably been one of the major problems of it. It's had three CEOs in the last 4 years. Anyway, the new guy comes in from Siemens Health, and I think he's got a background with Abbott Labs as well, so he's got a good turnaround experience apparently. And I'm hoping he's going to do us like a bit of a Rolls-Royce. The shares to me are got lots of recurring revenue streams. I think it's got gross margins of roughly around about 60, 70%. So it makes very good sort of, you know, scalable margins because it's IPR rich. You know, the objective now is to sort of get the top line going. And he started to do that for his last set of results. Sort of top line is increasing at about 5%, and the actual EBIT margins or adjusted EBIT margins are ticking up from 17% to 18% this year, and it's generating more cash. It does have a bit of debt, sort of like 2x EBITDA, but when you look at it on a valuation perspective, it just looks frankly too cheap. It trades at about just under 10x EBITDA, and the sector for medical devices at about 18x, and the sort of star in this sector, its big competitor is Stryker, which is on 24x. Now, admittedly, they've got better technology, particularly on the robotics. But you look at this and you just say, I know it's been a perennial takeover target for absolutely years, and nobody's actually gone for it. But it just feels as though it pays a sort of like a, I think it's about a 2-2.5%, you know, dividend yield. And if they can re-energize that innovations funnel with their new products, particularly in sort of like the wound care, which is an excellent franchise, and the sports injuries, which again is excellent, and then sort of like get the, you know, the reversal on the orthopedics to start working, which it did last year, then it should do well. And one sort of like data point that I've picked up from a lot of the corporate US results season is that a lot of the health insurers have actually been reporting really high claims in the US because lots of patients now, they feel it's safe to go back in hospital and starting to claim their, you know, health insurance, et cetera. So it's something that does seem to be, it should be turnaroundable, because this has worked in the past, and it just looks too cheap. I don't know if you've ever had a look at it, Neil.
I know it, and I think so. I can see the potential for the turnaround. The question you will want to be asking is just how much reinvestment in the business they need to make in terms of making that turnaround, and that's something which I think, you know, I mean, that's the quite a lot of questions in terms of, you know, just they've got some businesses which are quite capital hungry, and so, you know, what is going to be required effectively to help that turnaround. The other thing which I like about it is, I mean, I think it's an interesting way of playing. So, you know, when I talk to UK corporates right now, it there's a sense of caution. You know, you had a relatively weak sort of Q4 generally from a macro perspective. There's a little bit of concern sort of around Q1. I generally think the things are sort of stabilizing, but, you know, for those in supply chain, etc., there was sort of destocking, and, you know, the inventory needs to build back up. But I think that the way you need to look at the world is not be caught up in the here and now, but think forward to where you're going to be in 6 months' time. In 6 months' time, if you imagine that the rate cycle has started to change, and also you're getting into much easier comps, there's a feeling that stocks like this are basically going to start coming back into focus and get attention again. So I definitely think it's one where, you know, broadly speaking, it's the safer end of the sort of healthcare sector, but I think it's a good way of playing the healthcare sector and getting some early exposure to a sector which I think in due course is going to turn around.
Yeah, well, I think they probably, if they make the Rolls-Royce CEO, who is chairman of Smith & Nephew, then he'll have a rocket booster, I think, to needs another burn. It is like a burning platform molecule, I think, to really sort of jumpstart it. But a quick question coming in from Vincent to Denuit. What are your thoughts on Ashtead Group? Obviously, that's a plant hire business that has a big presence out in the States under Sunbelt, I think it is. And it's just benefited over the last 10 years, really, from infrastructure spend. It's now got reshoring. It's got the IRA Act. It's got the CHIP Act. And they came out with a statement, I think, this week. It was still growing and it was still very strong. But I think they were just starting to see some of the hotness taken out the market. I don't know if you've had a look at that plant hire business, because it is top quality, no doubt about it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know it as a business. I haven't looked at the sort of details around the more recent sort of trading update, but it's consistent with what you're hearing from a lot of companies, which is they're sort of citing a sort of sense of caution at this point in time. So that first quarter, as you know, has started, things have not gone off to the races. And I think, you know, you look at, you know, where these businesses will end up going. I mean, I think that clearly my view is that they will ride through that actually in the second half, you're going to get, you know, better growth coming through. And it's a high quality business. So from my perspective, it's a business that's run extremely well, done.
It's doubled since the pre-pandemic, isn't it? If you strip out the pandemic, it's still doubled.
Yeah, like, I mean, so it's one where when you've seen it got a little bit of a wobble, effectively, just because of slightly, I think you've got to look through that. I think it's looking through into, you know, where is the sort of second half this year going to be?
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's change sectors. Let's go to IT. In that Illumina portfolio, you've got Softcat there, which is effectively a reseller of hardware and software, largely in the UK, to UK corporates and to the public sector. And I think they put a sort of like a value add wrap on it. So they've got they sort of like concentrate in sort of like, you know, cybersecurity, cloud, all that kind of stuff, AI. Yeah. What's the latest on this one? Because, again, it's run pretty hard. It's not cheap, actually, but given what you've done with Rolls-Royce, then I'm guessing I know where you're coming from. So what's your latest on this one?
Yeah, so I mean, I like the sort of characteristics of the business. What I think, you know, last year the dominant theme was AI, right? And everything else kind of got forgotten to a certain extent. And I think there's going to be a little bit of a rebalancing of that going into 2024. And you're right that so businesses like Softcat and Bytes, etc., these are plays on effectively digital transformation, and you know, do you expect cloud revenues to continue growing? And I fully do expect that to be the case. So as a business, you know, a range of different streams effectively, but you know, the cloud services, hardware, software sales of various Microsoft products,
what's its USPs compared to the other consulting firms or IT resellers?
I mean, these they all compete effectively in terms of, you know, it tends to be on sort of service and ability to deliver efficiently, and you know, they're seen as a good strong competitor. In terms of, you know, things that you might want to, so what are the concerns around the business? Let's start with that. One is, it's still got a reasonably high exposure to the UK market, and it's one of the things that I tend to look at a little. If you're looking at it on a 2-3 year view, I think we're going to be okay. But this year, I think in the UK is still quite challenging, and there's plenty of people who'll tell you that, you know, they think the Bank of England have left rates too high for too long, and we're starting to see, you know, contraction in that activity. And then by the time they realize that we've over-egged it, it's going to be too late. And there's a little bit of concern about that. There's also, you know, they're undertaking an expansion, and, you know, as headcount grows, etc., are you going to see some margin dilution? There's that balancing act that you need the growth coming through. But, you know, if you then take a look at, you know, where it's sort of trading and where the sort of earnings expectations are going, it still looks interesting from a sort of growth perspective.
It's on 27 times PE.
Yeah, and look, I mean, that's right. And it's that's what you're going to have to pay for a high quality, you know, see is a high quality business with strong recurring revenues.
It's crazy, isn't it? Because in the US, 27 times PE for an AI orientated business or growth business is going to be frankly dead cheap.
No, it's right. But you are paying, you know, so compared to Rolls, you're paying more effectively for a business like this. I mean, we the way I look at these things is that, you know, we screen on a range of measures, and on a relative basis to others, this one looks like it sort of stands out. So, I mean, it's a pretty easy business in terms of, if you believe in the long term that, digital transformation, we're still under that sort of that long journey of digital transformation. I think they will do well out of that. And
when do you take profits in a business?
Wow, that's a really good question. So
sorry.
No, it's a really, really good question. So if you imagine that the way the Illuminated portfolio runs is that you take an even weight into 10 stocks. Okay. Yep. And inevitably what you're going to find is that through any period of time, you're going to get certain winners and certain losers. Yeah. So, you know, what I've seen is that, you know, let's say...
do you rebalance then? Quarterly?
Every month. So the Illuminator is updated every month, and typically it's relatively low turnover. So one stock tends to drop out and a new one comes in, and there's a little bit of sort of adjustment there. The question you have to ask yourself is that, let's say, you know, you put arguably saying £100,000 into 10 stocks, is you've got £1 million portfolio, and Rolls-Royce has gone up 150%, right? Suddenly, Rolls has got almost double the weight in your portfolio. Do you let that run, etc., or do you sort of take profits on the top? And I've been doing this a long time, you'll hear lots and lots of people say that the mistake is that you take profits from your winners. And so actually, I always have that temptation of, look, let's just rebalance the portfolio. But I've learned that I've just got to let it go. It's a discipline by I just let it run and do it until it tells me that actually it's got to where I think it's losing momentum, and now it's actually dropping out of the portfolio.
All right. Well, on that same logic, then, there's a question which comes in from this. Just let me just get the questions up, just so I can actually see it. From Vincent again, and he's basically asking about Judges Scientific, because that's obviously done really, really well. So let's just sort of like segue to that. So I've got Judges Scientific. If that had been in the portfolio, etc., on the Illuminator, what would you do? Because it's obviously just done brilliantly. In fact, yeah, I mean, you look back, sort of, even just recently, it's sort of gone up huge amounts. Well, sorry, the last, yeah, that's what that's the last. How many years? That's 86. Okay, so I mean, it's done absolutely fabulous. When would you, is that something you would just become too big? What do you
I don't
know?
think it's got too big. No, I know the business. I mean, and it's one of those sort of interesting businesses in that they've got a really interesting sort of niche. They then don't tend to be sort of too sort of overly promotional, getting out in front of investors, etc. They're quite company from what I've seen. An interesting sort of acquisition model in terms of sort of growing the business and sort of bolting on the right kind of businesses effectively to it. Has it gone too far? I haven't done the sort of fundamental work around it, but I know it as when I talk to other investors, lots of people regard it as an extremely well-run company. So
Yeah, well, it must be. Yeah, no, I don't know, but I don't much about it. I think it's high IPR, but to sort of like quadrupled, more than quadrupled in the last 5 years. I mean, it really has run fantastically, hasn't it? And I'm not.
it tends to come up in the type of people that tend to look at it tend to they tend to be sort of buffetologists. These guys like the attributes effectively of this company. I don't know how much the management own of it, but I'm sure it'd be interesting to take a look at that. But I'm sure there's quite a strong alignment effectively in terms of the management team and how they run the business.
Just looking at the valuation, actually, 20 times EBITDA for this year, given it's growing at well, double digits, then actually that's not too stretched for such a good business. The cash flow yield's only what, just less than 3%, so it's not generating that much cash, given where the actual the shares are on a shares basis. But I mean, that doesn't scream overvaluation to me, actually.
No, I mean, it's for a double digit. It's a business that's sort of had a track record of delivering sort of double digit growth. It looks like it's sort of an interesting one from a valuation perspective, and would sort of sit among some of the other sort of peers we're talking about.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, it's just on that the Softcat side. Let's move to a share that actually I've just bought just recently, called IOMart, which basically is a data center business. It's got and cloud. It's got sort of 12 data centers. Let me just put the chart up. It's got sort of over a 5 year period. Is it? There we go. Okay. It's got sort of like 12 data owns about 12 data centers in the UK. And then I think it leases data centers elsewhere in the States and stuff like that. I mean, the shares have done terrible, but if you believe the story that, say, Softcat and NVIDIA and all the other sort of like AI plays and cloud plays, they're going to be benefit. They're doing well in terms of what you'll need in terms of running generative AI, then they should do well. But the shares have obviously not responded, and they're in the small cap AIM sector. They just look, again, they just look frankly too cheap. They trade on roughly around about 11 times forward PE. They've got a bit of debt, but only about just over 1x EBITDA. The real sort of Achilles heel historically is that it's supposed to be a growth company, and it hasn't grown recently. And they've had a new CEO, or the exec chairman has stepped into the role. I think they're looking to appoint a CEO. And again, it's a bit like Smith and Nephew. It should, in the market, the industry is doing really, really well. Is this a business that can take advantage of the buoyancy in the market, i.e., you know, you've got huge amounts of demand for data centers and for cloud software and also cybersecurity, which is where they play. So you'd think they should do well. Recurring revenue streams are over 90% and gross margins are over 50%, I think. So it is definitely scalable. I don't know if you've had a look at this one at all, or even if your analysts cover it.
No, Dan will know it. I know he does look at it. I haven't focused on it, partly because the share price chart has been
Exactly. It's fallen out of bed.
But no, it's good. I mean, if you think that there's it's worth looking at. If you think there's a sort of turnaround coming, what do you think sort of led to that sort of decline in price? Because I've seen, you know. Yeah. It's the kind of thing I put in the other side of my portfolio. When you see a stock going sort of from 400p to 100p or something, you know, you think, okay, well, that's worth taking a look at, because you're either going to see the turnaround and start to see the re-rating, or potentially it's interesting enough that someone picks it up.
Yeah, I think basically it's been poorly managed in the past. I haven't spoken to the management team, so I can't sort of correlate that one in terms of, you know, the old CEO. But given the market's been growing in cloud and in data centers, these guys have had pretty anemic like for like growth. It hasn't. That's the reason why it's re-rated from being supposedly in the growth bucket to effectively a mature business that's just generating cash. And you've had a lot of questions now, I guess, which I haven't seen in the analyst report, but about whether it can compete against the hyperscalers who have, you know, big budgets in terms of putting NVIDIA chips into their data centers. The difference is that these guys look after the small, medium size business market rather than the big sort of global corporates. And you say you've also had a bit of churn, and they haven't yet really started to adopt Gen AI, but they are doing that. I know they are from the grassroots level. So that's still to come. But I think similarly, it comes down to sort of, you know, your top line. Have they been able to increase it? And people are getting worried that they'll be, you know, sort of like AI'd out or pushed out by the hyperscalers. But again, you say that there are different sides of the market. Plus, they specialize in hybrid cloud rather than actually straight sort of like, you know, cloud, etc. For small and medium sized businesses. And another sort of like indicator that I don't know if you ever look at it. It's anecdotal evidence, but I don't know if you ever look at sort of Glassdoor, which is a website that gives reviews. Yeah, well, the reviews on the employees, there's about 150 of them, is not glowing on what these guys have done. So I'm hoping it was, you know, it just has been a poor performer in a strong market. And I'm hoping the new exec chairman and the new CEO, when they appoint them, will be able to re-energize this business, change the culture, and start actually benefiting from the growth in this market. But I've got about a half position in it at the moment, so I'm going to be adding to it over time. But it probably isn't something, given the backdrop that you described in terms of, you know, moribund UK growth, that is going to particularly soar. But it could be taken out at any time, I'd have thought.
Yeah, and I think that's a short term. Issue, which is, you know, you need to get through the next 6 months, I think. And then I think so interesting time to look at it. I'm definitely going to do some work around that one.
Okay, well, let me know. I'll be interested. Okay.
Yeah, I will. We can pay notes next time.
Yeah, okay, that's good. Okay, well, let's move to a different sector. Let's go to the asset managers. It's just been brutal In that whole era, every single one of them has just been on listed market has just been hit. And you've got one particular, which actually has got a real strong niche. It's impacts, which sort of like goes into environmental and all green issues. And I think that it's got a pretty good niche there. Do you want to take us through your latest views on this one? I'll put the chart up in a moment.
Yeah, I mean, so let's start with the sort of the broader asset management space. And I think, you know, if you look at an Aberdeen or a Jupiter, et cetera, they've all had a pretty torrid time, partly because of flows. But also, I just think that, you know, they're not as developed on the sort of ETF and sort of passive side as you know, clearly some of their sort of bigger US competitors. And to be honest, until they sort that out, I think they're going to struggle. So, you know, if you're looking for exposure in the asset management side, where would you put it? The thing that I really like about Impacts is it's a niche little business. So, you know, if you believe that the trend of investing in a sustainable way is going to continue growing, then this is a good way of playing it. It's been running for about 30 years. They're extremely good at what they do. They're very well developed. You know, they get lots of recognition for the fact that actually, you know, they're a good, so they're not one of those funds which just sort of badges that they're fun. And, you know, you know, the regulators are cracking down on this, the whole idea of greenwashing. So they're not one of those funds that I think will get caught out of that. It's in their sort of DNA. They do a really, really good job effectively of investing in it. And so, you know, it's a deep green fund that you can look at. So big picture, I see that side of the business over the long term will continue growing because I just see flows into sustainable investing continue to grow. You know, you did have a little bit of a sort of hiccup over the lot, you know, so when the going gets tough and returns are harder to achieve, you know, there was a little bit of sort of outflow from the business, but actually they weathered that pretty well. And so to me, it's a sign of it's a reasonably sort of sticky business. What I also think is interesting is that, you know, it's because of its niche, you have the last business that was sort of like that, was Gresham House, you know, which had that sort of lots of interesting sort of niche sort of plays. And from memory, Gresham House was taken out something like 31 times. So Impacts has got significant upside effectively. Well, that is the 37 times, I think. So it's a business that's sort of trading at 14, 15 times, you know, and it, because it's a niche, it's an interesting business from that sort of perspective. What are the concerns and the things to keep an eye on? Again, because of the regulation that's sort of coming in, actually doing the work in terms of investing on a sustainable basis is expensive. You know, there's a lot of hard work that sort of goes into making sure that you're investing in the correct way, etc. And the margin element is something that you know, I would keep an eye on and just make sure that the costs are controlled. But so far, seems to have done reasonably well and managed to sort of weather the storm. It's, you know, revenues, I think, relatively modest expectations for 2024, but then starts to accelerate as you get out into 2025. You're looking at, you know, modest earnings growth for this year, but again, then you're starting to see a sort of scaling of that into 2025. So as we get through this year and people start to focus on the year ahead, I think, you know, all the asset managers, of course, are going to, you know, at that moment that you think risk is back on, these businesses will come back onto focus. And if I was to put my money in one place where I think there's less in the way of structural issues in the asset management space, Impacts would be the place I'd look.
Yeah. Well, I think in 12 months' time, if it stays independent, it's done pretty well. because given where the share prices are, I'm sure one of the big asset managers is going to come knocking on the door for that level of specialism, because you're right, it's a bit of a trophy asset in that sector. And you'd have thought with that specialization in all things sort of like ESG and environmental, it can't be passived away. It isn't something that is easy to be replicated and to go to have that cost, that fee game. Hence, it's a bit of a jewel in the crown in the industry. No, I'm with you.
Correct.
Okay, good. Well, let's move to again to another sector. I'm going to stay in healthcare. Small cap company, Diaceutics, got a really strong balance sheet. Let me just put the chart on. What does it do? This is something that is sort of quite confusing for a lot of investors to sort of get the head around. But there's two big trends in all things healthcare at the moment, certainly drug discovery. And is first of all, GLP-1s, which is anti-obesity drugs. Okay. So everybody knows about those. Certainly in the States, they've just roared. Look at Eli Lilly's. And the other one is, which has been going on for even longer, is precision medicine. And what that means is tailoring particular therapeutics to actually smaller patient populations, but charging more for them. Not so much rare diseases, but if you've got sort of like cancer, you might have a specific type of cancer mutation, and therefore you want to treat it in a slightly different way with a slightly different drug rather than actually using the blockbuster ones like Keytruda and this sort of stuff. And so what does Diaceutics do? It's really a picks and shovels pharma bit, or life sciences business, and it takes all the data from laboratory testing sites around the world. It also takes a lot of patient data, and also takes data from sort of like the biopharma sector, and helps those biopharma companies target or find patients that are going to best respond to their new medicine. So for instance, if you're a big, I don't know, Pfizer, or you're a big Merck, and you've got sort of like a cancer therapy, and you're looking for a sort of like, again, a sort of like a slightly different patient population, it's quite difficult because they're small. There aren't that many patients who suffer from this specific sort of mutation to actually find them and therefore be able to treat them and charge them. We're talking for smaller patient populations, big drug prices. They're all big, but these are significantly big, can be hundreds of thousands for a typical annual course, etc. So it's important that you maximize the commercialization of it. And these guys, because they take all the testing data from the labs and also got, you know, patient data from it as well, they can actually help the doctors and the pharmaceutical companies find these patients to be able to increase and accelerate the commercialization of drugs. So you increase peak sales and you shorten the time scale to get it. And they've got some case studies with quite a few of the big pharma demonstrating that. They're going through an investment phase at the moment, hence they're unprofitable, and that's really what spooked the market. But they have a big cash balance, which should keep them going through to fund them to become self-sufficient and cash positive, I think 2025, 2026, etc. But they do have a bit of a sort of like unique model, because there aren't that many companies who offer this type of, you know, sort of like service to the big pharma. And I think they deal with something like 20 of the top 30 around the world. It was started by a guy, Peter Keeling, I think it is, and then he's now with his son, and I think his son's now just taken over. So it's one to watch. I don't own the shares, but I don't know if you've had a look at this one, but it seems a very unique business model with sort of like increasing recurring revenue streams, 50%, but it makes 80% gross margins.
Yeah, and so we do know it. Sue Romanoff from our healthcare team sort of keeps an eye on it. We like the business. With all things healthcare, I think to a certain extent this has been caught by the sort of downdraft that you've seen in the sector. I think it's a really interesting business, interesting sort of price point. And interestingly, I mean, it feels like the management team are on the front foot, and you know, a usual sign of, you know, do these people have a journey to travel? You know, are they interested in sort of talking the story effectively to investors? The IR is really high on this sort of agenda for them in terms of communicating the story to the right sets of investors, and that's usually a sign that, you know, they feel that they're at the sort of wrong price point for the kind of business they are. So yeah, no, I like this as a business, and I think it's got, you know, the story I sort of played out with you for Smith & Nephew, which is that there are certain things which I think are going to come back in the sort of second half of this year. This is exactly the kind of business that I would be putting in the same kind of bucket.
Yeah, I'd agree. Actually, just tying a bow on Smith and Nephew, reminded me with the anti-obesity drugs, which I mentioned at the start. It's obviously hit the whole medical devices sector, but actually it could be a positive, and this is what the market doesn't understand, simply because people who are obese haven't been able to get hips and joints because they're so big that they can't, you know, BMI scores are so high, they're not allowed it. So actually, if they lose a bit of weight, you might find the increase of the population, but we'll wait and see. Okay, right, let's move again to sort of like consumer data. We've got YouGov, and it's obviously a monster year for elections in 2024. I think everything is going to get voted on. So if this business doesn't do well and knock the ball out of the park, I will be stunned. But if you could take us through your latest view, because it just bought one of its big sort of like, I think it was a competitor out in Germany for about 300 million euros, and it's integrating it, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, look, if you're going to look at it, I think the mistake a lot of people make is that they see, because they do the polling data and they see the name YouGov, et cetera, it's actually a tiny proportion of their overall business, the polling side. I mean, it's good for the brand. And you're right, it is the big election year, et cetera. And so you'll see that brand in front of people's eyes. What's really interesting about this company? So in a world where, you know, I mean, it's getting harder and harder because of the changes to, you know, what Google's doing on cookies, etc., getting an understanding of, you know, people and their preferences, etc., is getting harder and harder. And the value that YouGov have is that they have this absolutely enormous panel, 15 million people, I think, who sort of supply them with information, and that's on a global basis. So this that's, you know, so 15 million panelists, I think, across sort of 60 countries. They have got their data. So I think they call it the cube. And so this information effectively comes into a data lake, and they can slice and dice that data in lots and lots of different ways, and you interrogate it. And that's what people want. So people come to YouGov to get an understanding of, you know, how do people reacting to my product and so on. And that's the value of the business. The GfK acquisition is really significant. So the two things, it's, you've got a relatively new CEO, and I think he's got to make his journey with this company. They've always followed a sort of 5-year growth plan, and you know, they're into this next 5-year plan. The GfK one is probably one of the most significant things to look at. So it was a sort of 450 million euro deal. It's a German sort of market research company. One of the reasons that it's interesting, it's expanded their footprint. It's expanded their panel. It's added sort of complementary revenue streams, or sort of diversified their revenue streams. GfK weren't great on the data side, from what I talk to people within the industry, whereas YouGov are exceptionally good on the data side, and there's some really interesting sort of opportunities there. And then there's a fair amount of synergies and cost savings effectively on the sort of on the data operational side, etc., that they get out. So the whole key to me for the YouGov story is the integration of GfK, and the fact that I think is, if they do this right, it's going to lead to a leapfrog in both growth and profitability of the business. And it's, you know, the other thing I like about it is that it's very hard. You know, they're sitting on this gem. You're not going to get these sort of data lake of 15 million people, or now with the GfK, a large data lake. And that's becoming more and more valuable over time.
Mm. Yeah, I think if they can get that integration right and cross-sell the services from both businesses, obviously GfK's into YouGov's, and, you know, and likewise YouGov's, that data side into GfK's, then they're increasing the share of wallet for those, the similar sort of customers. So that's a huge, and the gross margins, I'm guessing, you know, the drop through rates are going to be massive.
It's almost
like pure profit. So yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I don't like to use cliche words, but it could be potentially transformational, this deal for them.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. I mean, the thing to do is, I mean, I like it. It's, you can see the potential for it. The trick is the execution, effectively, in terms of are they, you've got all the, make sure you integrate it correctly, et cetera, and that you're getting the benefits of it. But this is, it's a smart team of people. You look at, what do you take comfort from? Just go back and look at YouGov's earnings history, et cetera, and this, the consistency with which they have delivered. And I'd give them a strong bet that they're going to do well out of the GfK acquisition.
And it wouldn't surprise me if one of the bigger advertising agencies bought these guys because they need this expertise, and it's so unique. Again, another industry trophy asset, your likes of Publicis or WPP, or I can't remember, that there's one out in the States as well, isn't it, or something, but the big three, and it'd just be a drop in the ocean. I mean, I know it's a 1.3 billion pound business market cap, but a couple of billion quid be dropping the ocean for them, I guess.
And look, I mean, I think if market insights are going to become more and more valuable, right? And so I think they're really an interesting company with an interesting growth trajectory because of the acquisition.
Yeah, we've had actually a question on market insights, just on research. Where, and I know this is probably playing to your sort of like, where you're strong, but where is it best for investors to get sort of like equity research and in terms of accessing that, because it isn't always available, in one place or easily for retail investors.
Yeah, no, so as you know, Paul, I was at the PLC Awards last night.
Yeah, you're doing
And
rather well there, actually. Yeah, you're still a fairly compos mentis.
Bim Afamami spoke at the PLC Awards, and it was an interesting sort of, he sort of recognized the importance of UK capital markets. And in particular, I mean, it's the, there's two levers that the government is pursuing. One is, pension fund reform to get more, more of the pension money investing in the UK market. The other is, re-engaging the retail community effectively in UK stocks. We are underweight compared to other markets in terms of, our retail investors buying into UK companies. Various sort of planks to that. One of them being, NatWest. The NatWest government stake is going to be offered on a very, very broad basis, supposedly. There is a move to create a UK research platform where people can go to and access information on UK companies.
Wow.
Don't know that much in terms of details, but
You're
that
going to
is
be
being worked
nationalized
on.
there, Neil.
No, I mean, I think we will be a contributor into this, and so will other the other
Okay.
brokers, but that this it's a push effectively off some of the reforms that are taking place. And currently, look, I mean, there are sources, so you can go to, firstly, come to our website. I have to say that because we cover a reasonable swathe of the market.
And I
And
just highlight to
yeah, so
investors, actually, we also, you kindly allow us to circulate your reports, and it is top, they're top quality, and they're really good. I mean, I've been using them as an investor for, well, basically for 30 years, or certainly for 20 years anyway. So yeah, no, they're well worth having a look at, because they put the numbers out there, and in terms of the company, they are basically the final guidance. So if you ever look at somebody's when they come out with reports, etc., then you can always compare them to those figures
Yeah,
to see whether they're up or down.
and then there are other sources, so you can go to ResearchTree. A lot of companies are now hosting analyst research on their investor relations pages themselves, so there are tools that allow them to host some research. So I think, this idea that information is gradually becoming democratized is definitely available. And the other thing I'll tell you is that information is consumed in lots of different, it's not just research reports, things like this that we're doing, are growing in popularity and interest because people, want to dip in, hear about a couple of stocks, et cetera, and then, they will go off and do their own work in different ways.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. Okay, good question, that one. Let's move to another fallen angel that I just wanted to highlight to investors, and it's Cake Box, which is basically the UK's number one sort of like luxury fresh cream cake business, and it's another one which is a fallen angel. It listed about 5 or 6 years ago, IPO'd, and then did well during the. It actually did very well in the pandemic. Had a few sort of like stumbling or growing pains in terms of the accounting and its financial systems, and also some of its infrastructure. That's beefed it up. But a couple of shareholders have jumped out, and then it sort of bottomed out around about just over a year ago, and since then sort of tracking up on increasing like for like sales. And this is what I highlight to investors: it's still very cheap. The important bit: it's a franchise model; it's capital light; it makes good margins. So gross margins are about 50%. But it's like-for-like sales, if you look at it on a half-year, sort of like 18 months ago, they were slightly negative at about 1%. Then 12 months ago, they moved up to about 3%. And then in the last reporting period, I think they were 6%. And they said the outlook for H2, which is to the year-end March 2024, they were about 5%. So the momentum has returned. And of course, you're going to get good drop-through rate. And as I say, it's a franchise capital-light model. So the balance sheet is absolutely, you know, pristine, rock solid. They've got about 7 million, or they should do forecast for the end of March on 40 million shares. So what's that, around about 14-15p per share of cash. And they got actually some M&A interest about, I think it was middle of last year, which was that spike at about 160 from the Australian cheesecake shop or River Capital. That was a bit of a mouthful, but and I can see why, because I mean, this is what I quite like about these sort of consumer stocks. I mean, my family has tried Cake Box's product on numerous occasions, and I can absolutely categorically, it is fabulous, really, really good, and I can see why they,
thanks for that.
Yeah, and I can see why people keep returning to it. And, you know, it's good value. It's an affordable treat. And again, your people have sort of like, you know, worried about what the impacts of a recession has been on the business. But actually, you know, it's that demand is normalizing after sort of the cost of living shock from last year. And you've seen that coming through. And also, you've got energy prices subsiding, which is, you know, when they bait the sponge and this sort of stuff. So that's helping. And they've still got a good growth pattern. I think they've got about 215 or so stores in the UK. They're going to hope to increase that to 400, but they're online. They've pushed quite a bit of sales and marketing spend into sort of like, you know, digitization of the sales. It's about 20% of their franchisees' sales, and it's increased from, I think it's like 12 or 13% sort of 5 years ago. So that's going up, even though the sales have also significantly improved. And just on a valuation, as I say, it trades at roughly, well, it trades on less than 14 times forward PE, pays a 5% dividend yield because it's got a rock solid balance sheet. And an EBITDA, it trades at 7.5 times. And frankly, that is just too cheap for well-respected franchise model. I mean, typically these would be 10, 11 times, you know, sort of stuff. So, I mean, my fair value, I don't own it, but my fair value on this one is £2.10. And I could see this one going a lot higher. I don't know if you've ever had a look at this one at all.
Yeah, no, we know it. And firstly, like you, my family, yes. Anytime there's a family birthday, that's where the cakes come from. So I know it from a consumer perspective. And so interesting the way you're looking at it. And, you know, if you were doing some work on this, what I'd recommend is go the very kind of similar situation to maybe where Greg's was, you know, 5-10 years ago. And, you know, if you look at the Greg story, what's driven that? Well, firstly, they run the business very efficiently. Second, and so you want to check, you know, how efficiently is this business run? Secondly, it's the expansion of the storefront. Yeah, so, you know, you go, that I think drives your organic growth. Greg has had a really interesting sort of digitization strategy, and that leads to the sort of customer stickiness and repeat buys, etc. And that's something to take a look at. And then I think less relevant to Cake Box, I mean, Greg's have, you know, expanded effectively times people come into the store. I don't know if there's possibilities for that for Cake Box, or whether they introduce sort of adjacent sort of categories, etc. to make that happen. So I think there's a really interesting mirror offer. You know, there's a company which is in the sort of similar kind of sector, which has done very well and is now caught the sort of imagination of a lot of investors. Cake Box is running a very similar kind of strategy.
Yeah, I mean, what I think is interesting, and it hasn't been part of their strategy yet, is to look overseas. But let's be clear about it. An Australian cheesecake shop thinks this has got international appeal. It would not be buying it because it's got no presence in the UK, okay? So in that case, somebody who would be prepared to put a lot of money on the table for this business thinks that actually we can internationalize this at some point in time. So the UK is only a small part of the world, and there's nothing overseas if they ever, ever decide that actually, you know, there's some growth opportunities there. So you get that optionality. Plus, you know, as I say, if you've got one person looking at it, there'll be other people also probably running the slider all over it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, it's in that consumer sector, let's move to another one in your illuminator, 4imprint, which came out with results. And I mean, it's another sort of like starts the bottom left, moves to the top right chart, isn't it? It's sort of like done really, really well. So no apologies for your performance. It's been pretty damn good.
No, and yeah, again, I put it on people's radar. It's a phenomenal. So they won Growth Stock of the Year at the PLC Awards yesterday.
Oh, okay. Right, I'm not surprised.
Phenomenal track record. It's an unusual business in that, it's listed here in the UK, but it's predominantly a US-based business. What do? They produce merchandising. So, you know, you want your logo on a baseball cap or one of those sort of coffee cups that keep your coffee warm, etc. They produce that kind of marketing for a range of different sort of customers. It's an absolutely enormous market. It's a $20 billion market. It tends to go with sort of, you know, economic cycles. So, you know, as things pick up, you tend to see more activity. As things become a little bit more cautious, you know, you tend to see marketing spend coming down. But what 4imprint have had the benefit of is that it's a hugely fragmented industry and they continue to gain market share. And so, you know, it's still tiny, you know, they have 4% of this 20 billion market, and they can continue growing that. So quite a lot of this, you know, their growth is in their own hands. What makes them really interesting as a business? They're just really, really good. You know, the thing we started off with, which is, you know, high quality service, etc. Really, really good. So they understand marketing. And, you know, they've got this sort of very good symbiotic sort of relationship with their customers and their media partners. And they know how to be really effective in terms of, you know, promoting people's brands. They are an exceptionally efficiently run business. And, you know, they have the kind of the things that you used to get years ago, the John Lewis promises of, you know, If you find it cheaper or if we don't deliver it to you on time, you'll have your money back. They run those kind of guarantees effectively for their customers. And I really like that as a sign of, you know, a confident business that is doing a great job. And they, you know, they run out of a sort of single facility in the US. When the pandemic came, they didn't get rid of anyone. I mean, you know, activity collapsed, but, you know, they looked after their community. They hired everyone. They're a really important sort of employee in the US. And these are things from an ESG perspective we really like, that it's a well-run business that looks after its people, that looks after, you know, its clients, etc. And that they're just undergoing an expansion effectively of their facility. And that is, I think it's going to come on stream back end of this year. I might be wrong about that, but it, you know, so you're going to see effectively higher sort of growth coming through. Q4 was tough, but they grew. And so, you know, they gained market share. The things you want to keep an eye on is just making sure that they can, you know, they don't have any supply chain issues. They can continue growing. etc. But Love It is a business. It's really well run. Fiona, the analyst, has, I think she's valued at 60 pounds.
So it's about the same price currently.
So it's about 58 pounds right now, etc. Well, when she published the notes on the results, maybe
it's 61 now.
And,
it's 61.
So like, I mean, it's kind of hit her valuation. At the same time, you know, I mean, it might, while it might be sort of sitting on sort of fair value where she is, I still think that they get it from something that I want to own that's got all the attributes of something over time that is going to continue growing.
Yeah.
Here's your compounding, you know, you're a perfect compounder that I can see them sort of delivering 15%, 20% growth year on end, every year from here on in.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's done really well. So I guess one question would be just on margins. It's just 10% EBIT margins. Is there any opportunity or scope to increase that? Because it's sort of like a, I know they're, it's sort of like tailoring and customizing sort of products, but that does seem for a sort of like a, you know, impulse type, just sort of small value item for marketing budgets, quite a, something which has got scope for to go higher on, I thought.
Yeah. So it's not just tailoring. It's actually
upside.
You know, they spend marketing dollars effectively. So it's looking at the effectiveness of their marketing. Have we seen a sort of growth in sort of underlying margins? No, I mean, I think it's a top line rather than a margin story right now. So I'd focus that. And look, inevitably, you know, you would expect that with scale will come some benefit to the margin, but I think the opportunity is more on the can you grow your revenues and of, you know, start to sort of get a significant share off this very large market. And I think as long as they keep doing what they're doing, which is, you know, be good in terms of their marketing ability and run the business efficiently and in a good way, looking after their people, I think there's a really interesting story there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic run the winners, isn't it? Okay, if anybody wants to ask some final questions, please do, or we'll poll them just in a moment. We'll move on to the final stock, again, in sort of healthcare that I'd like to raise, is Venture Life. Now, this is one which is basically an OTC healthcare products business. I mean, it's a small version of something like Haleon, but and it's growing at around about sort of 5% like-for-like top line, increasing its margins as well and reducing its debt. There's the actual chart, but the big difference with somebody like Haleon, I think trades at about 15 times EBITDA, whereas Venture Life trades at less than five, and Haleon's on about 20 times or so PE, and this one's on a less than seven. So there's a significant valuation. It's been dropped. It's been left for dead, really, in terms of its price. It started to, you know, increased just recently as some of the small cap fund managers have started to come back in, which is very, very interesting. And I've got a sneaky suspicion if they can make sure they hit the targets for next year, for this year, 2024, and they did that perfectly last year, I've got a sneaky suspicion we're going to see a big re-rating in this because, again, it's sort of like, you know, it's niche OTC healthcare products with high stick, you know, client revenue or consumer stickability. And you've got, you know, improving margins. I mean, they only make at the moment less than 12% EBIT margins, but that could easily go to 15 to 20% ultimately. And what I really liked about their recent trading update, I think they've got their full years probably sometime in, you know, their April, but their recent year-end trading update, they said most of that 5% like-for-like growth had come through from volume, not price. And so, and the price benefits are coming through next year. It just looks totally mispriced for effectively a high repeat revenue business with niche brands in a sector that is improving in terms of sort of like, you know, demographics and healthcare. And it's less than 40 million market cap. I don't know whether you've had a look at this one, but
off my radar, but I'm fascinated by it now you've mentioned it.
Yeah.
I was having it on screen.
It just looks mispriced. I mean, I know I've mentioned a few of them in the healthcare space. Smith and Nephew totally mispriced. Diaceutics looks totally mispriced, and this one likewise. And I'll get a sneak suspicion you've got two sort of trends. Everybody in healthcare investing has gone to anything to do with GPL1 and just abandoned anything else. And then also you've had, you know, just generally in the market, anything considered as sort of like, you know, old economy, which isn't, but healthcare, you know, sort of like stuff has just been sold off as everybody's trampled into the Mag 7 or did last year, and into anything AI with an AI mania. And it just looks, I think there's some really good opportunities for high IPR businesses with good growth prospects, strong margins and defensible positions, even in a defense, you know, in, if we go through a tougher economic period.
Yeah, no, looks. I'll keep an eye on it when results come out. It's not one that I've looked at. I mean, it's a name that sort of flashed across my screen, but I sort of haven't focused on it at all. So if there's a valuation anomaly, it's definitely worth taking a look at.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, just one final question before we leave it then, Neil. Just outlook for equities in small cap land. I know you look at really sort of like your large cap, mid cap, and small cap, but there seems to be most of the pain has been certainly in AIM and in small caps over the last 12 months.
And look, I mean, I don't know if you saw the interview I did with Gervais.
I can guess what he said.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, Gervais has been long-term bull. And there's the interesting thing is that, you know, if he was bullish on, you know, the small cap effect and small in the UK in particular, in terms of, you know, it's now that we're through the credit cycle, you know, these sort of cash flowing, dividending, yielding sort of companies will really come to the fore. He's been joined by a bigger chorus of people who have sort of identified that the UK is at this sort of, you know, all time low from a valuation perspective. And you can go to Schroeder's site and see the work that they've done and sort of identifying that. I spent a lot of time talking to Gervais about, you know, actually, well, that's great, but what's going to catalyze change? You know, what is the thing that's going to unlock it? And I'll come back to, you know, the things I'm observing right now in the market is that you would have absolutely been right to allocate your money into US tech last year. The returns speak for themselves, right? And that now, what you're seeing is that now people are looking to diversify out of that. And what is interesting is that rather than if you did it last year, typically a lot of people would have put that money into equities, and, you know, small cap equities would have been a beneficiary of that. The thing that's detracting from that right now is that the crypto in particular has suddenly found a place in people's portfolios.
And not mine.
Part of that is, I know, and not mine either. It's one of those things that I haven't bought into it yet. But I, you know, it's a 1.5 trillion asset class now, half of which I think is Bitcoin and the half is the other stuff. It's creeping on to the point where it's starting to be institutionalized. The BlackRock crypto ETF was the fastest growing ETF, I think. And you know, that's detracting from the flows into what you'd normally see in the sort of our UK equities. Now, so that's one thing, which is, or equities generally, I think, you know, that's something which I'm sort of picking up on. The other thing which I would focus on is the thing I've sort of spoken about all the way through, which is that right now, when you speak to management teams, they're very, very cautious, right? They've had a sort of choppy Q4. You're seeing, you know, there's a range of profit warnings that you've seen, whether it's XP Power or Halfords or, you know, and that uncertainty or slightly more sort of cautious trading statements. And I, you know, I think that there is that sort of setting of expectations of it's still challenging. There's this, you know, we think that the UK market perhaps is going to remain challenged until, you know, the Bank of England does something about rates. But I think they will. And hence, I think the thing to do is not focus on the here and now, because you just won't do anything. You need to look forward to, you know, where you want to be in September. And I think that the portfolio positioning always takes place sort of 6 months before, effectively, for what you think is going to happen. And I'm really optimistic, effectively, in terms of a return for UK equities, the interest in UK equities, for the very simple reasons that I cited, which is, you'll see an easing of rates, and that should be good for valuations. And the comps get easier, and that should be good for growth rates. And so you've got this sort of Goldilocks scenario, effectively, of growth and improving valuations, and that should lead you to, significant returns. So I would say that, look, I think pick your winners now, and so find interesting stories where you think actually they're going to be resilient or have got turnaround, that a lot of self-help over the next 6 months that's going to get them forward. But that I'm quite bullish. If I'm joining Gervais's camp,
Yeah, no,
but with
I'm
a
as
view
well.
of
I'm as well.
it will
Okay.
take care of itself,
Okay. Actually,
probably
just
in a second. Yeah.
in 5 nanoseconds, we've got which got from Carcosa. He just asks what areas, which sectors are likely to have the most consolidation? I mean, I could name a bucket of them, but
Yeah, and the UK is extraordinary. If I was looking at consolidation within the UK, but there's a couple of things I'd focus on. One is find those business, so industrials, basically the boring businesses where they've got, interesting niches, regular government streams of money, etc. There's lots and lots of interest in those kind of areas, and private equity will keep coming in and buying those businesses because it's an industry that can keep consolidating. Have a look at what Marlowe's done, etc. Now Marlowe's split up. You'll see that continuing. I do think the asset management space is really interesting. And I mean, off late, now that you've seen Virgin Money sort of being picked up, I think the UK bank space is going to start looking interesting as well. I mean, you've got some very big banks there, but there's other smaller banks where I think there might be some activity as well. So yeah, I mean, I'd paint actually the whole of the UK
Yeah,
market
so would
based
I.
on the valuation.
I don't think there's many.
Looking at it.
I don't think there's many areas that wouldn't be because the valuations are just so attractive.
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Well,
Yeah.
thanks very much, Neil. Unbelievably marvelous insights there. So look forward
No, it's been
in t
really fun today, Paul.
yeah, well, we'll look forward in touching base in hopefully a couple of months. And best of
Yeah.
luck after Easter.
Thank you very much, Paul. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand, and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want, with PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards, so you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.